plate a potential nugget.
Let's dive into the book. I must say I fall in that bucket of learning history through dates and events, and probably not absorbing some of the deeper lessons from history. But off late over the last few years, I've been intrigued by history, and I'm sort of making up for lost time, if you will. For example, recently during the Christmas break, we went to Hampi, and as a family, we were just blown away by, you know, just the magnificence of the city, the vision of the king, how much got done, the architectural beauty, and so on. And we'll talk about some of that along the way. But I've developed a late newfound respect for history, I must say, in terms of my journey. One of the things I wanted to talk about, Pradeep, diving in, you talk about multiple kings and queens in the book. As a coach and as a leadership development practitioner, I was curious about how some of these kings and queens were developed. What can we learn from some of the practices that were in place in those days to ensure that a king or a queen was ready to take on the responsibility?
Right. So this is a very ancient tradition, Deepak. Hitopadesha is something we may be very familiar with from our Ramachatra Katha days. The Hitopadesha was a text that was written for princes to be great kings. So In India, we've had a long tradition of kings being groomed to take on higher positions, and in a way, queens as well, because women were also educated. They were also expected to live to a certain position and do certain things. But I want to take the specific example of somebody like Tipu Sultan. Tipu was somebody who was definitely in some way groomed by his father, because at a very young age, he saw battle. And I think that was one of the important reasons why he understood the need to fight, the need to emerge victorious, the need to work with his troops, and above all, the need to build alliances. And he built he had a very strong respect towards the French. But later on, if you look at Tipu, his number one aim, in a way, was to drive the British out. So he should be feted today. He should be one of our biggest heroes, but he's a very controversial character. And the essay delves a little bit into that. So if you look at what he's done in Kerala, for example, there are many good things that he's done in terms of the administration. He really worked hard, because that was a time when the Kerala spice growers were harassed by the Portuguese and the Dutch. And Tipu really set the administrative system right. But he's also come in for a lot of flack for the religious aspect. And if you look deeply for Tipu, and I've deliberately taken the bull by the horns, as it were, to pick up controversial characters like Babur and Aurangzeb and Tipu, because it gives us a sense of how nuanced these characters were. Nobody is a good person or a bad person. There's a lot of shades of colors for each of them, just like each one of us are. Yeah, I don't think any of us can claim to be completely 100% good or completely 100% bad. There's always a little bit of both, and there's that gray matter in between. And with Tipu, there are many things that were in his favor in terms of his ability to expand the empire, in his ability to wage war in different fronts. But the one thing that he realized, and probably realized too late in life, was the vital importance of building alliances. And by the time he realized that he was not going to win the battle with the East India Company, because of their superior military technology, he had actually lost the battle, because he had fought with all his neighbors, and he'd become very unpopular in his own region because of his fighting with his neighbors. And by the time he wanted to build connections with Afghanistan or with the French, it was a little too late. So the way I've taken that insight is, sure, we can have a conversation about, was he a good king or a bad king? Did he do the right thing or the wrong thing? But there's no point in that in terms of me improving my performance. Tipu's dead and gone for many years. But what becomes a useful conversation is, hey, I want to leave a legacy in the way Tipu wanted to leave a legacy. I might not want to drive the British out. I might want to partner with them today, but I certainly want my name to be there. I want to expand my geographical spread. I want more books to sell. I want my writing to reach more people. For that, one lesson that I can learn not to do is to build alliances. And unlike Tipu, I need to know how I can go out and build alliances with people, give and take a little bit, so that my geographical spread becomes larger. So you see, in a way, I've sidestepped, in a way, I've avoided this I think, futile conversation of good and bad leaders from the historical perspective, to look at what is a need that they operated from. Were they able to achieve their need? Why did they not achieve it? Why did they achieve it? What insight do I have from that for driving my own performance?
Going back to Tipu, Pradeep, I want to sort of come back to the making of the king, right? If you want to shine the light on, you mentioned Hitopadesha, right? As a manual for making of the kings and queens. Are there, I'm sure these are large pieces of work, so I don't want to sort of oversimplify it. But are there, let's say, elements that we've forgotten, and we could, we could be well served to focus on some of the elements that have been covered even in the Hitopadesha?
Not just the Hitopadesha, but even if you look at Rayavachakam, which is a book that Krishnadevaraya wrote about statecraft, or if you look at Babur's accounts of his life, one thing that comes across, Deepak, that is a very relevant lesson for us today, is the potential rulers were encouraged to patronize the arts and the humanities. And I think that was because in the arts and the humanities, unlike in STEM or in science and math and technology, you don't have one right answer. There are many ways in which you can view a painting. There are many ways in which you can cook something. There's many ways in which you can understand history. There, and when it comes to the heart and the words, there is a lot of bias involved in it. So it's important as we read these old writings that there are different accounts of it. Immediately it springs to us that there are different perspectives. And I think that that sense of openness of different perspectives, the willingness to accommodate different perspectives, is a very important training that comes across in all the statecraft lessons that we have from the texts of the past. And I think that's something that we don't have too much today. I think engineers are wonderful people in terms of and highly qualified people. But at the end of the day, we know emotional intelligence is much, much more important today to succeed in the long term.
Almost like a liberal arts mindset, if you will, right?
Absolutely. The old adage, right, that IQ can get you a job, it's EQ that gets you your promotion.
This reminds me of an insight from Ashish Dhawan, founder of Chris Capital, a private equity fund. When I asked him about what it takes to be an effective investor, he speaks about the role of humanities and liberal arts.
Yeah, so I think there are a few. And I would say, by the way, I think liberal arts education is good training for the PE business, because I don't think you can be unidimensional. A lot of people think to be a PE investor, you've got to be good at, say, economics and analysis, you know, just data crunching, reading balance sheets, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it's much more than that. I think that at different levels, you need to be fairly skilled. The first is, I think, at an emotional level and psychological level. I think a deep ability to somewhere be a critical thinker, to have confidence in your own thinking, but yet keeping an ear to the ground and being able to listen, but being able to filter out what you're hearing. And to be able to control your emotions, I think, is absolutely critical. You know, the when you are an investor, you're surrounded by a lot of market noise. And I think the easiest thing to do is to be wallowing in other people's thoughts, or in the, you know, dancing to the rhythm of the market. And in fact, the best investors are contrarians. To be a contrarian, you have to have that in your DNA to be able to think independently, to almost stand up to the crowd. But in this case, you can't do it. You can't remove yourself from the crowd, because then you stop listening, because you can get things wrong and sometimes do need to pivot. So I think that's one essential trait, is know thyself and think deeply about yourself. Be a little bit of a psychologist almost at one level. I think at a second level, you have to be a, you know, big picture person, almost a macroeconomist and a historian. Macro, because you got to understand, you know, how the economy works, different sectors, what the drivers are, and at a very fundamental level, have a sense of that. But a historian, because you have to understand, you know, how industries have developed over time, how market cycles have played out, having that perspective of how it's happened before, how bubbles got created, you know, what were the best times to invest. So I think having historical perspective, I believe, is absolutely critical. And being a little bit of a big picture thinker is important. You can't just say, oh, I'm looking at this company and doing due diligence. You get too narrow and you lose the forest for the trees, in a sense. So I think having that trait is important.
As a family, we just came back from a trip to Agra and Fatehpur Sikri over the spring break. And some of the Mughal architecture and history is top of mind. Talking about a liberal mindset, I was personally blown away by Akbar and his spiritual program titled Deen-e-Ilahi, intending to merge some of the elements of religions of his empire and thereby reconciling the differences that divided his subjects. The elements were primarily drawn from Islam, Hinduism, Zoroastrianism, Christianity, Jainism and Buddhism. I also discovered that Akbar was a first principles thinker and was deeply curious about many things and was willing to let his beliefs evolve rather than sticking to any one strong belief. It's really deeply inspiring how some of these kings led their lives and how relevant some of those traits are today. Thank you for listening.